Loan officers, this one's for you. And as I go around and speak to everybody in the industry, there seems to be a big disconnect on taking not just technology down to the loan officers, getting them to use it. People are exhausted, and that's why they're not installing the next technology. And I was speaking with a CMO who said, capital markets people, same frustration. They think they're rolling out this awesome product and it is awesome for 4 days. And then it somehow gets lost as in translation as it gets to the branch. So with that said, if you're a leader, a lender leader, or a loan officer, this is going to be the great reset. This, what you're going to hear today, is going to be something where you should go into the office later today, tomorrow, whenever you're listening, and say, okay, we're going to do this right this time. We have these programs, we have these products, and that's what you'll hear about today. You'll hear about it on probably specific deals or loans or programs, I guess is the better word for it. But you'll also hear it philosophically. Our guest, Rudy Orman, has been out there speaking with lenders. He's been working, you know, with the candle lit into the midnight hours now, trying to keep up with the volume, because it's one of those places, and you'll see Mike and I talk about it, and you'll hear more us talk about it in the future, and you'll know why, but we won't reveal it on the show. But there is a lot of demand out there in Wall Street for certain types of product, and it's now loan officers get to supply it. And I can't tell you, there's a lot of money to be made, and there's a lot of ways to help home ownership problems with this in inventory. So you're going to hear it on this show. And the reason this guest is so special, I guess, is because I do talk a lot about going to the conferences and growing up in the industry. And there are certain times where you're in a room and you just need to get off to a good start. No one's talking to you. Wow. It's like a sports game. You know, you start off not talking to anybody on a Sunday. You can find yourself Tuesday flying back with only two business cards. So I've been introduced a couple times at the secondary conference, and now it's carried over to IMB, MBA annual, where Rudy Orman has not just said hello, agreed to meet, but especially in New York, taken me under his wing. And I really got to know he's not just, he didn't grow up in the mortgage industry. He really grew up in that Goldman Sachs Wall Street world. So it's just truly fascinating. We're going to get into it today. Before we do ask you to give a like or subscribe, especially if you're listening to us on one of the 11 different podcast ways we have now, or YouTube means a lot to us too. For some reason, everybody asks how many subscribers you have. We have tens of thousands of viewers, but subscribers, we have about 70. So we would love to get to 100 at some point. With that said, we do tape every week live at 2 p.m. Eastern.
And of course, at 11 a.m. Pacific time here in sunny San Diego.
And we do that so you can comment. So if you do comment, we try to reward you on LinkedIn by getting your comment up there, talking to people like Rudy. It's good branding for you. And until there's too many people doing it, we'll keep promoting you to come back. But we do it to try and be the first show where eventually guests will be like, okay, let me take some questions from the audience. No one else is really doing that. Not going to say that the attendance couldn't be better on that live show, but you can always find us, like thousands of people do, on however you're listening to us now. And so with that, we'd like to say thank you, Rudy, for coming on the show. And usually we don't go into the whole, like, how'd you fall into the mortgage industry? But I think there's something about your story that our audience will enjoy. So maybe you could just talk about how you did get into the mortgage, and maybe talk a little bit about that Wall Street piece, because I think that part fascinates, whether it's a loan officer, a regional lender, or even the owner. You know, that everybody, not to hog the mic here from the guest, but when I got out, I was a finance major. Everybody wanted to get into finance. Then when you were a mortgage loan officer coming out of that crisis, you were a little, the most recent, 2008 one, you're a little self-conscious. So you're like, I'm a mortgage advisor, financial advisor, but you're really not. Like, there's many different names for it, but you're not the same type of finance person that is out there on Wall Street and that we aspired to be for a while there. So maybe you could talk about your journey, and then we'll get into the type of loans, non-QM, and then the opportunities. And this is right in Mike's wheelhouse. So I think it's going to be an exciting talk today.
Yeah, thanks, Mike and Mike. Appreciate the time. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here. I got in the business. Undergrad at University of Florida, got moved back to St. Pete, got a job as a whole loan trader. right out of college, doing government loans. Fast forward, I got into the second mortgage business working for Citibank. This is in the early 90s. And second mortgages turned into subprime. So eventually, I got my MBA, all that while I worked in Citi. Eventually ended up at Household Finance. So I was Household for 10 years. And I started their correspondent group for Household. Household was a big finance company. They didn't do broker business. They didn't really do anything but retail. And they started this correspondent channel. I helped grow that business to the largest subprime mortgage aggregator in the country. And then, long story short, I had friends at Goldman Sachs. They were starting a conduit. So they hired me and I helped start their subprime conduit. I stayed in Florida, but I was in New York every week. Subprime was great when it was great, and it was terrible when it turned terrible. I was there all the way to the end, 2008. And then I actually, when the market crashed, and I actually ended up working for a hedge fund and getting into distressed until the non-QM business emerged. And so I started a non-QM business for a bank in Nashville for a while. And then that bank sold, and then I came over to NQM Funding. So I've been here a couple of years now helping. I did not start NQM Funding. Dan Scrocco, great guy. He's the one that started it. He got it going. I've been friends with Dan, and he's been a client of mine over the years. I introduced them to MassMutual, and they actually ended up making an investment into the company. And today, I kind of oversee the whole TPO channel as well as I help on the, you know, the investor secondary market. We are up to almost $500 million a month in non-QM business through brokers and correspondents. Of course, a lot of business we do is correspondent, and we've been doing a lot of like whole loan trades. Most of it gets aggregated and goes to the insurance company's balance sheet. Some of it gets sold to an RBS structures. But we're humming along. I think we're probably top five non-QM aggregators. We're not the number one or number two, or probably not even number three, but we're up there in volume. It's a comfortable number to have. I don't know if I want to get much larger, although Dan, who's a very competitive guy and my boss, wants to be number one. I'm always like, number one, I'd rather be number three. Or number four.
Can we bring some context to that number, Rudy? The number you mentioned, that how much volume approximately are you guys doing monthly yet?
Well, we're probably averaging in the 400 range, 400 million. I think we'll hit 500 this month, sure, or next month.
So if you were to compare that, I know it's not your space, but if you want to compare that to like what they consider agency or Fannie or Freddie, right? I mean, $400 million a month for a mortgage company to do in volume is a lot of business, of course.
Right.
But when you take into consideration that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, $400 million is like, well,
nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a drop in the bucket. So for our listeners and our originators that are out there thinking that $400 million a month is a lot of money, you know, that's it's really nothing. It's actually a small percentage.
Right.
Of
so dog years comparing, you know, non-QM to agency. It's really about how much money you're making. So you're figuring you're probably going to make between 75 to 100 basis points net. If you've done it right, probably less than, it's probably net. It's probably net before tax is probably 5/8 to 3/4 in basis points after you pay your, you know, you pay out your commission versus you can't. You don't make that kind of profitability. I don't know what agencies right now. I think really all your value in agency is the servicing, right? Pretty much. So you're obviously making a lot more money per loan. You're doing less loans. It's a pretty good formula, right? Do less, make more.
All right. So can we go back in time a little bit more, like 30 years in time?
Okay, sure. We can. I was there.
Yeah. And so back in those days, in your whole loan trade, first of all, whole loan trade basically means you're trading the entirety of the mortgage loan.
Yeah.
Not just servicing, meaning that the entirety of everything. And for our listeners that don't know it, they just need to know. And so back then,
there's two parts of the mortgage. There's the loan and then there's the servicing. And then there's the 50 basis points difference. So like a 5% MBS bond is a 5.5% mortgage rate. And then they bifurcate the 50 basis points servicing, and then the other goes to the bondholder.
Got it. Back then, you had mortgage brokers, like individual, like mom and pop mortgage brokers. They would take their portfolio of private money loans, and then they would sell them to a household finance or an associates or an Apple Finance or American General or whatever. And, you know, they would originate these mortgage loans, and they might have like Mr. and Mrs. Higher income or higher savings family, and just say, hell yeah, we funded this $100,000 note. We're going to sell it to household finance. You'll get your money back, you know, in 6 months after we sold the loan or something like that.
So that's private credit. And that's like the new buzzword in Wall Street now, private credit. Private credit. Private credit's been around forever, right? But yeah, it's funny. They would come to you with these loans, and they had them documented so pristine. They had an index. This is when you're dealing with paper files now. Echo based on both sides, and you know they would dress these loans up like they were beautiful, like it was fantastic, and they would try to sell you these loans, right? And you know they're charging like 8 points on the front end, and they were trying to make, you know, 5 on the back end. They're making like 13% on these loans, and the rates were very high back then. So they were probably 400 basis points higher, maybe 500 basis points higher than agency rates. This is before FICO, so you had counters. You didn't have credit score. Can you imagine that? So you counted the 30s, 60s, 90s, and how much credit, the depth of credit. So that's old school. You know, you had the thumb. Remember the thumb? They had the big rubber thumb going through the file.
Yeah, because
Echo. Yeah. But, you know, those days are gone. But yeah, that's how it used to be. And it's probably in a good way. It's in good and bad, right? It's just different, right? So I remember those days. I would crack files just like that. And, you know, it was done a lot differently than today.
Well, you said it was 75 basis points today for you guys to do it today. Do you think it's possible for a correspondent broker or lender to maybe not make 75, but, you know, earn more on front and back? And we talk about that.
It's a little harder to make that kind of money when you're brokering the loans. It's a little easier correspondent. So some of our clients, we deal with some big lenders, and they've been brokering the non-QM. Because let's just talk about non-QM, right? Non-QM was in its infancy, and it started to grow, and then the pandemic hit. And then it paused. It didn't stop, it paused. And some people got burnt over it. When I was at the bank, we didn't burn anybody. We bought what we said we were going to buy, and then we paused the program. Not everyone got burnt, but some people got burnt. But it was a global pandemic, and we also ran out of toilet paper and paper towels. You guys remember the pandemic, right? You could go to work for a year. You couldn't go to a restaurant. There was a lot of things that happened, not just the non-QM business stopped, right?
A lot of supply chain too. I mean, the busiest Costco day of the year this year was a couple of weeks ago in preparation of the shippers strike. Everybody went to get the toilet paper, even though I believe they were trying to say Costco does so much in the country now that wouldn't have been a problem.
So I don't want to minimize. Some people got hurt when non-QM stopped because their investors they were dealing with, they were thinly capitalized, or So there were some bad characters, some bad actors, some people just stopped, didn't care who they burnt. So people got burnt. It happened. But it was a global pandemic. It had nothing to do with the product. I personally had probably $120 million of product on the bank's balance sheet that I had to sell. We waited. And then when the market cleared, we were profitable. We made money on those loans. So it came back quickly because the performance on 9QM continues to be very good. These are strong borrowers, average FICO in the mid 700s, average LTV in the mid 70s, and average reserves are like 12 months reserve. So these were like really good borrowers. They had a ton of equity. And home price appreciation went up, continues to go up. So this wasn't subprime, and I was in subprime, and I don't really want to see subprime come back. But this is better than Alt A or subprime or anything like that, because you have real liquidity, you have real LTV, you have real asset, you have real reserves, and the credit scores are very high. So these are like second, third, fourth time home buyers. These are not first time home buyers. These are not low credit score people. So when the pandemic hit, it affected not only the toilet paper and the and the paper towels, but it affected the 9QM business. And after the pandemic, we got toilet paper back and we got 9QM back. So
where would it be now if that didn't happen? Just real quick. Like it sounds like in your voice, you're saying that you'd be doing 750, 750 million a month because.
Yeah, it would have been a lot further along. Yeah, it would have been a lot further along. I couldn't guess, but that was a punch in the gut. And so but the reason I brought that up was a lot of the bigger guys, lenders, are and still are brokering 9QM to us, but I'm seeing them turn around and say, yeah, you know what? We're going to start banking this stuff because they're going to make more money on it. They were brokering it because they were attracting loan officers and loan officers were like, well, I got to be able to do a bank statement. They're like, yeah, you can broker that stuff. They weren't making any money really on it. They were just getting the loan officer to hire them and let them just appease them to broker this stuff. So like I deal with some, I'm not going to name names, but I deal with some of the biggest retail lenders in the country, most of the biggest retail lenders in the country. And I'm having conversations now, like you guys are still brokering this stuff. Well, the pandemic, I'm like, well, remember the toilet paper story I told you, you know, like really.
And from a recruitment standpoint, this is the part I keep harping on show after show since somebody told me it, but Cross Country announces 3 months ago, I missed the article, someone pointed out 25% of their business is now non-QM. Why that is important is recruitment, because if you're not brokering it, and who's to say, but if it actually goes into the P&L of that branch and that branch moves from company to company, that's the first product. Like their conventional loans, I don't think are going to the distributions at the end of the year. There's not enough there. There's enough to keep the loan officers busy, like construction companies take bids to keep their carpenters. So when they get the big one, but same thing here. But these non-QMs, there's enough left over so that the P&L gets bigger, so you can do those distributions at the end of the year. My point is, new company wants to M&A or acquire that region, and they come over and they say, well, where are these loans? And you don't have them, that they'll go back or they'll never come. So I think I can see why sometimes it is follow the leader. We're not going to say Cross Country is not one of the more influential recruiters in the country. And if they're doing it, if you don't keep up, and that's why, since I heard that, I've been trying to get into as much non-QM talk as possible. Also, Mike's very involved in it as well.
Well, yeah, what they did was, so they created like a joint venture with an investment banking firm, a couple of ex-Goldman guys. They brought over a guy from another non-QM aggregator, and they got into it hardcore, where they share in the securitization profitability. So, you know, you start brokering it and then you become a correspondent And then maybe you keep the servicing and then you become kind of an issuer, right? Just issue your own RMBS. So they went from brokering at rate to being, you know, issuer, although it's not their shelf. It's an investment banker shelf, but they share in the profitability, the upside of these loans, not on the primary market, not on the secondary market, but on the capital market side of it. So they're actually, you know, earning money on these loans, you know, every month. I'm not sure how the JV works, but I'm certain that they're part of that, you know, payment stream that you get when you hold the residuals of the structure. So that's great. And I'm surprised more guys are not doing that. You got to really, you know, jump in whole body to get into that, though. It's not just the dip of your toe.
So along those lines, Rudy, then when we went through two extremes, one, just, you know, people are just brokering like, okay, non-QM. And then we talked about one large IMB is just like, now they're doing everything. They're chief cook and bottle washer, earning every single dollar on every single thing. When does an individual broker say, you know what, I'm going to go from broker and now I'm going to be a banker, but I'm not going to be an agency banker. I'm going to be a non-QM banker. When do you think they should sit there and go, you know what, I'm going to stay in my lane, or, you know what, get out of that lane because they're not making you any money out of the agency business because there's so little inventory of that. And there is actually more, because of the lack of business that's out there in originations on the non-QM space, that means there's more opportunity. When does the broker actually enter into that space so they can become more profitable, not only on the front side of origination, but, you know, there's 24 months of bank statements to collect and there's more documentation and so on and so forth. How can we go to our broker audience and even the smaller IMB audience and say, you know what, this is how we can prepare you to be a better correspondent to non-QM?
So there's a couple things to that statement or question, but if you're a broker, a mortgage broker, you're probably doing some non-QM because most brokers, that's why you go to a broker, because they have all these options and different things available to them. So you would generally go to a mortgage broker because if you go to a bank, they have a product. That's it. You either fit or you don't. You go to a mortgage banker, they have maybe 5 products and the broker has 100 products. But to be a broker, to stay a broker, to do more non-QM, you gotta go after it. So non-QM borrower either comes in by accident or on purpose. So the accident is, hey, I can't get you qualified agency, that cool low rate, but I think I could get you a loan over here. And the rate is or something. It's a little higher. Let me get you approved first. And then, yeah. So there's fallout there because the borrower thought rates were at 4% when they're really at 5.5% and they're going to get a 7 or 8% loan. So that's a big number. So that's reacting. And sometimes you could catch people, sometimes you can't. Then there's going after non-QM borrowers, right? So the first thing, place I go to, every time I talk to a mortgage company, I go to their website and they got product, conventional, FHA, VA, jumbo, right? 4 things. They don't have any non-QM loans. And we don't get any non-QM loans. And my joke is, you know, nobody orders pizza at a Burger King, right? Because it's not on the menu. And if you ask for Burger King, they're like, nobody orders pizza here. Can't understand why no one's ordering pizza, you know? Same, it's a good analogy, right? So it's like, where's your tab for self-employed borrowers? Where's your tab for real estate investors? Because there's 3 times as many self-employed borrowers as there are VA borrowers. Nothing against VA borrowers. You got a tab for VA borrowers. Where's your tab for self-employed borrowers? And then where's your tab for real estate investors, right? Most real estate investors.
You pointed out, Rudy, to me, this eye-opening fact too. The non-QM loans, the self-employed loans, those are typically your referral sources too, right? And there you said real estate agents actually are a big user of this, the way they get paid. So if you're able to deliver to somebody that can deliver back in gratitude through referrals because of the experience you can give them through that process, I think everybody focuses on the one deal that could be a little shaky and not the nine deals that go out and the, you know, you times it by five, 45 deals that come back in. But when you said that, now you say it again, title attorneys, like really anybody that's self-employed.
Yeah, realtors are 1099. We have a 1099 program for realtors, right? No, we're not just realtors, for any 1099 borrower, right? Self-employed borrowers, most self-employed borrowers write everything off on their income tax. And a lot of self-employed borrowers, we have friends, my wife and I have friends that he's self-employed. And he told me one time, he's like, I could never get a mortgage. I'm like, have you looked at non-QM? He's like, I don't even know what that is, right? So there's a lot of guys that are out there that are like self-employed. They're like, I can't get a mortgage because I write everything off my taxes, right? So go after self-employed borrowers. Every good realtor works with 1 to 5 or 10, whatever the number is, real estate investors. They all have real estate investors for pocket listings and speculative real estate investors. It's like, hey, man, let me talk to your real estate investors. I have a DSCR program where I just qualify it on the subject property. I don't care how many properties. I can have 100 properties. I don't even use his income. I just use the DSCR ratio on the subject property. That's all I care about. And a lot of those people, those real estate investors, they got 10, 12, 15 houses. So one loan could be 8 loans. And by the way, his brother-in-law's got 14 houses too. So then he's going to be like, hey, you should talk to this guy, Mike, because he can help. He helped me out on 5 of my houses. You know.
Hey, but by the way, you're running a P&L for an 11-person branch, and they've done 40 government loans, and you haven't seen really anything come back to the branch because that's the way the margins are right now. Then you take Rudy's example, and you have about 80 deals right there. And guess what? All of them, not only did the loan officers get paid, but your branch margin, your P&L is now, it's going to be a great December for you to set your goals, either reinvest or maybe take some out. Like, that's not going to happen. And then it multiplies. This is why.
And by the way, a lot of these business purpose loans, you can originate in other states and not have to be licensed because they're business purpose loans. So you can expand your business that way.
Rudy, I teach a cash flow class down here in San Diego, and I often tell the people who are coming in who own multiple properties, that I'll tell them, look, it's not the borrowing rate that you borrow at. It's what you keep in your cash flow at the end of the day. And they go, what does it mean? A higher rate, still a higher rate. I said, yeah, but here's the deal. If you can, you know, there's a website called Bigger Pockets. And on that website, they have what's called the BRRRR strategy. It's buy, rehab, refinance, and repeat. Right. And they're like, well, what about the, you know, isn't there like a prepayment penalty? I said, yeah, well, if you bought a property and you own it for 6 months, 12 months or whatever, the value, you bought it for 250, it's worth 500. You only owe 250. Go ahead, pay off the prepayment penalty, cash out on it, still cash flow on it, and go buy more. And I think that it's lost that people get, the consumer has a little bit of fear in paying prepayment penalties. They have a little bit of fear in paying points. I think that instead of thinking that those are no, and that word penalty is just a not a very good use of that word. What it really should be is yield maintenance. The investor decided to give you a debt so that you can do that. Because if you were to be able to borrow money in the form of equity from another investor, equity is always more important, is always more expensive than debt. So the yield maintenance or the prepayment penalty is actually cheaper. Yeah. And if you were to go to your neighbor who had $300,000 or $400,000, and now you got to share 50% of that because maybe you didn't understand it before, and actually paying all these points and the fees, actually it's to the benefit of the borrower. And that type of information's not being conveyed to the loan officer to be conveyed to the borrower. Therefore, anyway, go ahead. You can speak.
A lot of those guys are so seasoned real estate investors will never question their prepayment penalty. They get it. And it gives them a lower rate or better terms. So the longer the prepay, the better terms. Maybe first time investors might be worried about that or question that. I get that. So what you do is you give them the rate without it to buy it out, and then you give them the price with it, and then they'll take the prepayment penalty. Because the cash flow just works better with a prepay. So there's that. And then there was another point you were talking about. We were talking about prepay, and I'm missing the point.
It used to be it was a 6-month prepay and it was 5 years and that was the end of it. Now prepayment penalties are a little bit different. Now it's like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. There's the soft prepay has gone. Soft prepay is when you were, it used to be where you sold a property and that penalty was away. This, that's not realistic anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember what I was going to say. So the loan officer sometimes is the problem too. So you could have an experienced real estate investor, but a newer loan officer, and they are afraid of the prepayment penalty. I've talked to loan officers on the phone. I'm like, no. Give it to him with it and without it, and he'll take the prepay 100% of the time. But the loan officer's like, oh, I don't know, you know. So we always, old adage about you never sell from your own wallet, which means just because you wouldn't buy a Rolls Royce doesn't mean you can't sell a Rolls Royce, right? Just because you wouldn't do it doesn't mean you can't sell it. So you never sell from your own wallet. So just because you wouldn't take it or you think the rate is too high doesn't mean the borrower would agree with you. They might say, I need it. I need this money. If I'm a real estate investor, you know, my cash position, I need the leverage. A lot of these guys are buying 5, 6, they're putting bids on 5 or 6 properties thinking they're going to get one. Well, they might win 2. And they're like, oh crap, now what do we do? Call your father-in-law. Let's see if we can borrow money from him, right? Or whatever. So then they have to use leverage. They have to borrow. So they'll borrow to buy these other properties. They'll take cash out on one property to buy other properties. That's leverage, right? And the cost of leverage, they understand it. It's better than borrow from your father-in-law sometimes, or friends, or private money. It's going to be a lot cheaper, or hard money. So the newer loan officers, they have to understand like the environment that they're in, they're dealing with, and these consumers. And it's always helpful. I've always been very inquisitive. So if I was a loan officer talking to these real estate investors, I would ask them, like, how do you make money? Are you borrowing all these? Like, I would ask them, like, I'd ask them like 8-10 questions, because I'd just be curious on like, how do you make money? How are you making money? Oh, now I see. So by borrowing money, sometimes that's better than using your cash. Sometimes using your cash is better than borrowing money. Get it now, right? And then it's just math. It's just a math equation.
That's the message that I think you want to relay to them, is listen first and then kind of sell. Like, this doesn't sound like something you really need to sell. It sounds like something you need to get some information and then show them, because it's almost, and I don't know if it's the further away from California or the further away from New York City, but the further away you go, the less competition, because they might be running into many loan officers that don't know about these programs. So they end up down at Tommy the accountant, that's much higher, right? Or,
well, the other one is interesting too, is we go up to 8 million on exception. We go to 5 million on program. So these like $8 million loans, the rate is pretty high on that, right? So you're like, oh geez, on that loan amount, right? But most of these LTVs on an $8 million loan are like 30, 20%, right? These guys pay cash for these houses, right? You can't put a loan contingency on a $30 million house. You just can't. You won't buy it. You pay, so you use your cash. And then you do like a delayed purchase, right? So you get 7-8 million back, right? From the 30 million in cash you did. And then your accountant takes that 8 million and he invests it in something else. So the interest rate is, while everybody always asks, what's the rate, right? You know, I don't know. High. But what do you need the money for, right? You know, are you going to just sit on $30 million in this beautiful house in Southern California, in San Diego? But if your accountant says, we need $8 million to invest so we can make $16 million, we could double our money. Who cares what the rate is? It's leverage. It's cost of leverage.
As Amari Cooper says, you either are moving or you rust, right? Get that money moving.
Well, What do you think that the average broker needs to learn, or the originator, not just broker, but what do you think the average originator slash small mortgage brokerage owner needs to learn how to ask their customer? You said ask a lot of questions, but what do you think is the question? And I know you're not in the trenches, but if you were to sit there and go, you know, what's the question that they are not asking?
So it depends on the loan and the if they're self-employed, the first thing I would ask is, so like, what is your tax? Are you showing income or are you not? Right? It's obvious if you're showing income and you're paying taxes, don't get a non-QM loan, because I mean, you get better rate if you go, you know, agency or even jumbo, right? So they're like, well, they might tell you three lies or whatever, and you just keep asking questions. Really? Oh, okay. Oh, so like, how much money do you pay taxes? Well, not really paying a lot of taxes. Okay, so you're probably writing stuff off, I'm guessing. So I have a program for that. The rates are going to be higher than agency, so you know, because this is going to be like an insurance company or it's going to be a Wall Street type loan. So 150, 200 basis points higher than agency rate. And if it's a purchase, you're like, you know, so, you know, I can get you to buy a house. I need your bank statements, whatever. But, you know, ask them like questions about their, like, be inquisitive. Sometimes people don't like that. So knowing to kind of back off a little bit, go, oh, okay. So you make a ton of money. That's great. So you must be paying a lot of taxes then, right? No, I don't pay much taxes at all. Okay. So, all right. So like you're already, you know, you're kind of getting the information from the guy. Just by being inquisitive but not being too prying. It's always kind of a give or take, right? You're sort of interviewing them and they're interviewing you kind of thing. But the big thing is don't be afraid of the borrower, you know? I've talked to borrowers before and it's like, they're like, you're asking too many questions. I'm like, look, there's two ways to do it, the right way, the wrong way. I'm going to do it the right way. If you feel like I'm asking too many questions, then find someone that's going to ask a lot of questions, right? I guess. I don't know. Like, I need to do it a certain way. I know how to do this. I've been doing this a long time. You know, sometimes you got to like push back a little bit, right? And I know that's tough. That's easy for me to say on this call, right? It's tough. It's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but you got to get good at being able to kind of be ask the right questions, push back a little bit, and just kind of play this sort of cat and mouse with these borrowers. Generally, if the borrower is straight up, you don't have to do that. But if the guy's a little shaky and he's starting to demand things, and sometimes you got to tell him, look, man, this is what I do for a living. I don't come to your job and tell you how to do your business, right? I can do it your way, but I guarantee it's going to be bad and it's not going to have a good result. So that's the pushback.
Yeah. I just posted a question. And one of the questions I would encourage originators to ask is ask their borrowers, do you want to pay more taxes or do you want to pay more interest?
Right.
Yeah. You know, I work with family offices and one of them had a larger bill, a seven-figure bill. And they said, you know, at the end of the day, we don't mind paying more taxes because that just means we made more money. Right. But if there's a way to mitigate that, and to reduce the possibility of that, meanwhile figuring out how we can, you know, use our real property in order to do that, then how do we do that? Not how do we do that, but how do we do that? And I think that in the non-QM mortgage space, the question is not asked, how do we do that? Everyone's just scratching their head. Well, how do we do that? I don't want to pay the points. I don't want to pay the fees. I don't think it should ever be that argument. I think you agree. It should never be how many points and fees do you want to pay? It should be more like, how do we do this more often so that we can increase your cash flow? Because I think you would rather know that this year, maybe you paid $2,000 in taxes and maybe next year you paid $8,000 in taxes. But guess what? Your cash flow increased by six times. And I think there's a lost art in that translation of how to earn more income versus I don't want to pay the points and fees. And I think that's the value proposition that originators are losing at the moment. I think there could be a greater amount of education in that space. I don't know, by the way, I don't know yet what non-QM is, as far as the company is concerned, is doing to provide that greater education. I just know that they're offering the product and the environment for the IMB to produce more. And there just needs to be more education in that space by the lenders.
I want to say, I do want to tackle the how you work with IMBs, why IMBs should be, that watch this should be, you know, working with you, Rudy, and working with us on helping distribute this message. But before we get this message out there, why is, with buyers agents go kind of losing their bread and butter, why wouldn't the real estate agents be the ones that take with the baton that apparently loan officers dropped a little bit there and be the, if they already know the investors, a two-part question, why aren't they doing it? And then can you explain the difference between somebody borrowing in an LLC versus personally, and if there's a difference on, I guess, licensing that you would need or what type of loans there are? Because it sounds like it's still me, but I can buy as the LLC of the house versus, so I'm a self-employed, this is for the audience. I'm a self-employed borrower. I own a landscaping company. I also own 7 properties. I'm guessing you're not asking me to get my business purpose loan under my landscaping company. It's under an LLC that the house is in. Is that correct or incorrect?
So you had 2 questions. Let me go to the realtor question, then I'll go to your LLC question. So the realtor question is, why aren't realtors originating these loans, right? Well, that, you can say that about all mortgages. They're giving all these leads away and, to these loan officers, right? And back in the day, you know, they were making 6% on the sales price, and the loan officer was making 1% on the loan amount. So you're better off focusing on being a realtor than being a loan officer. Also, and I'm not, listen, loan officers, mortgage people, cats and dogs, look, we're 2 different people. I'm on the loan officer mortgage side, not the real estate side. But they generally, when they do make a loan, they generally give it away to get the real estate business. So they're really not, the loan piece is not that attractive to them when they can make so much more, you know, on the sale. And I'm sure there are realtors that also make a great loan officer, but how many of them are there? I think there's 3. All right. So then let's go to the LLC question. So if you're a borrower, you're buying a business purpose and it's a business purpose loan, so the title is in the LLC or your name, that's really has to do with, it just depends on your tax situation, your personal situation. A lot of times, you got a divorce or wife and they don't want the property in their name and they put it in the LLC or whatever, or they're, you know, how, whatever reason, nefarious or otherwise, you want the property to be in, not in your name, in the LLC. I don't care. Okay. I need a person, Mr. Kelena, who is going to sign the obligation that if the loan goes bad, I'm going to go after you. You can put the loan in the LLC's name. You can put the title in the name. I don't care, but you're going to sign too, and you're going to be obligated because I'm going to go after you in default. I won't report your name on the credit report unless the loan goes in default. And then everything falls back on you. So we can play nice and pretend as long as the loan is performing. When the loan goes into default, then I go after Mr. Kelena. Said with the Boston accent.
A couple, what's Michael that line Kelena. You want to say to me? A couple harpoons?
How about some steamers and a harpoon?
Steamers and a harpoon. So we're kind of coming to the end of the show here. So everybody's obviously all excited, and Mike and I, we got some work to do on helping loan officers get this into a podcast in their local area. But who is it? Does it have to be the president that reaches out to you, Rudy, or does any like branch manager reach out, get some information and bring it to there? Like, how can we get this ball rolling?
I would like the president to reach out to me, but they don't. It's usually they're still trying to cut costs, you know, like I still got to cut costs, you know, it's like, why don't you try growing top line revenue instead of cutting costs? Let's grow top line. We were at a session at IMB and they were like on the table with everybody talking about, hey, come up with a great idea. What do you think a great idea is? Like, just, you know, create the flying car, right? And we went around the room and all these guys are still talking about cutting costs. And they get to me, I'm like, we could be inventing the flying car right now. Like, you can say anything you want. Mine is like, how do we find a borrower before they know they're a borrower? How do we find people to that are going to buy a house before they even know and get to them? Like, stuff like that. Like, think out of the box.
Yeah, the exercise was like, if you had a magic wand.
Yeah.
So do it. You're going to cut underwriting time on with or
no, they're still cutting. They're still headcount. They're still trying to cut their costs so they can make their profit. I'm like, why is not anyone talking about top line revenue? There's two ways to make money, right? Revenue or costs, right? You can't cut anymore. Grow your revenue. And the exercise, you could have said anything. You could say, look, I'm going to, you know, invent, you know, a unicorn, whatever, right?
Yeah, if you wanted an easy answer, you could have just went to Rudy and would have said, put self-employed loans and real estate investment loans on your website, right?
Grow your top line revenue, guys. Anyway, but unfortunately, I usually get like either the regional guys or it's the loan officers, the originators, or they'll harangue the secondary guy to the point where the secondary guy will just say, oh, all right. And then they'll just call me like, I give up, you know, just.
Do they do flyers or do they get their own flyers? Like are they, I ask this because I think that's been the problem is like nobody knows anymore what to give the loan officers to use it beyond day 14. Like
we have flyers. We have all that. It's not flyers. It's going how to go after the real estate owner investors and how to go after the self-employed borrowers and just go after them, market to them. Flyers are probably not going to do it. Start with your website. You know, there's, you know, CPAs, calling those guys. There's investment clubs, calling those people. Get your realtors to give you leads that are real estate investors. Just go after a different kind of consumer.
And what's the branding you would say? Would you say, I'm the loan doctor, or I am the self-employed master? I'm the fix and flipper. I'm the,
the cash flow master.
The cash flow master. Okay.
I'll leave it up to you guys. You are that's you two guys. That's where you guys shine. I am not that guy.
The cash flow show has come to an end for today. Any final thoughts as always? Thank you, Rudy, for coming on. And thank you for just being who you are at a lot of these industry conferences. I see you help out many people that that others may walk by. I always say I always love the founder of Carrigot, when one of his speeches for something I was doing talked about how he always says hello to people on the way up the elevator because you never know who you'll see on the way back down. I think you carry it very well. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you guys for having me. Appreciate it.
Any final thoughts, Mike?
No, I think that I still consider that the average current LTV on an investment property, given how many free and clear properties there are that are investments, is like, 30%, which means that if you had $1 billion, of mortgages, that means you have like $300 or $400 million of equity that still remain untapped for the purposes of acquiring even more property under this space. The originator still has opportunity for the families that are beginning to move together. The opportunity in non-QM is still very much better and underserved and undereducated in the space currently at the consumer level. The originator and the industry can do itself some good by pursuing more of this business.
Thank you, everybody. Well said. Yeah. I was going to say mic drop, but it's overused. We are mic'd up.